Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
One of my favorite scenes was when they were first deciding to let Saul go. And you have like the one hardcore sister who's like, we can't let him abandon God and blah, blah, blah. And then there's like the headmaster father. And he's pretty much just like, well, yeah, Jesus. But like, did you see those deeks? Like God gave him a silky mist or something. Let him out there.
To a very special episode of, depending on where you're getting this podcast, one of two podcasts. This is either Burritos and Other Less Important Things, aka Bowlet, a movie podcast that I do with my friends Nate and Zach. Hi, Nate. Hi, Zach.
Hello.
What's up?
Or you're listening to Brews and Bruins, a podcast that I do with my friends Cam and Drew. Cam and Drew, how are you doing?
Wonderful.
Excellent.
All right, so this is going to be released on both feeds, but structurally, it's an episode of Bowlet. We're going to talk about...
So it means it's way too long?
Yep, it's going to be a little longer.
Only two people will listen to it, so it's great. We'll have as many listeners as ours.
We're going to split this into episodes. In the first episode of Brews and Bruins, we're going to talk about the films Miracle, Indian Horse, and Slapshot. And then we're going to take a break. And on Friday, you'll be able to hear us talk about Goon and Ice Guardians. If you're listening to Bowlet, you can spoil that second part for yourself and just blow through the whole thing. Wouldn't recommend. But yeah. So usually what we do on Brews and Bruins is we start by introducing the drinks that we are drinking. Let's skip the ratings this time just for time purposes. Cam, why don't you lead us off?
All right, we got something from Cigar City Brewing. It is a, depending on how you pronounce it, either Paloma or Paloma Goes. Refreshingly tart, it says. It's got lime and salt in it, so feel like something light tonight, even though we're watching hockey movies. I got the thing that said like boat case. It was like a variety pack, so we're still living in the summer, even though we're rating hockey movies today.
Just work your way through that whole case while we're
I'm planning. I'm already a few in. This is phenomenal, by the way. Actually, really refreshing.
Amazing.
All right, Zach, what are you going with?
I am going with a Negroni, which is usually what I've done with most ballot recordings, and it has always steered me wrong. So
Drew, how are you feeling? What are you rolling with?
I'm feeling good. I'm starting to catch on to the spooky season vibes, which is nice. I got a pumpkin down east.
Very nice.
Awesome.
37.
Great. Nate, what are you drinking?
I am drinking, I got as a belated wedding present, a thing of Blanton's single barrel bourbon. And it's way too fancy. And I feel wildly inappropriate using it on this podcast, but that's where we're at. So a Blanton's neat.
Would you describe to us and the listeners what the cork of that bottle?
Yeah, it's wealth. The cork is, if you know, like the Ralph Lauren polo, it's basically that just on the top, like that logo. And the rest of it is shaped like a sort of a hexagonal orb of some kind. So
is it like a Death Star?
Yeah, something I would never spend money on myself, but it's really lovely to have it. So yeah, not bad.
Yeah, I think that top just was cited in the Pandora Papers this past weekend. So it was great.
I have a Coronado Brewing Company Weekend Vibes IPA. It is Monday.
Illegal.
Drew, it is Monday, and I am not happy that it's Monday.
I like that as it would have been better as it is Monday and I'm not happy.
That also true. do we want to go around the horn and kind of do why we picked each of our films?
I think we should probably start with just how we feel about hockey in general.
Let's do that.
That's kind of important where the three hockey folk can start and then us idiots can join in after.
Yeah, Drew, why don't you lead us off?
Just like about hockey in general.
Yeah, you start from the beginning. So,
the very first organized indoor hockey game started with a fight. I'll get to that later. In my defense of a very, very long documentary that's too long for that topic. It's just an amazing game. I love the butterfly effect of it. I think it's more active in that game than any other sport, where just the little things are so important in the outcome and the flow of it. Not a lot of stoppages, just constantly go, go, go. I've just always loved watching the sport. I don't play it at all, but just, street hockey. I'm an expert rollerblader and I'm a good skier and I have never ice skated. So, which is basically those together. I totally could, but I've always grown up loving the sport from afar.
Cam, on the other hand.
Bobby Orr.
Yeah.
More likely.
I definitely wouldn't say that. I'll tip my hand a little bit here and say that one of the things that I think Drew's movie actually did get right was the part where they talked about the kind of the adrenaline that is kind of natural when you're playing at such a high speed. And hockey is a sport where there's a lot of room for individual greatness, but also team creativity. And you kind of have to have both to succeed. And then when you're doing that, that's present in a lot of sports, but then when you're doing it at 30 miles an hour, it's a little bit more intense naturally when you're playing or watching. So I think that's the biggest draw for hockey for me. But as far as what it means, that's a long book that we don't need to dive into right now.
We'll leave that for Doc Emmerich.
Yeah, exactly.
In a soliloquy.
Yeah, I kind of adopted hockey a little later in life than most devout hockey fans. But for me, it really was the high speed kind of nonstop action that drew me in. And what kept me is just masochism. It's the most annoying sport to watch. It's anything can happen. Your team can be the best team on the ice for the entire game and still lose. It's maddening, and I don't know why I watch it, but I love it.
Perfect. I think I would probably describe myself as an extremely fair weather fan of hockey. I will watch the Bruins occasionally, usually in the playoffs. I love going to hockey games. I think it's probably one of, if not the most fun sport to see live. I got to grow up in Amherst, where UMass is, and went to a bunch of hockey games there and have been to a couple in the city. Always super fucking fun, but I just can't find myself to follow the sport along too much. But whenever it's on, I like watching it. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, for me, it traces back sort of to two separate things, which were D2 the Mighty Ducks was a constant staple in the house, and NHL Hits was a game that I was pretty obsessive about when I was younger. And so from those, obviously, like I always felt interested in the idea of the sport, and doing like having a stint of doing a lot of rollerblading and stuff like that, I felt like that sort of put me in the same lane, but I never really followed it actively other than going to some games during college and going to some games at UMass, similar type of thing, getting probably too inebriated and shouting that I have a very distinct memory of getting very drunk and thinking it was a good idea to yell, to have a whole crowd yell safety school at the school that was beating us by 10 in one game as a way to feel better at ourselves. It's one of, and I think this will probably come up, but it's one of the movies that I think has certainly one of the highest ceilings for films.
when you think about sort of the way a specific sport translates to a film, there are certain sports that translate really well. There's certain sports that kind of like gain a lot from being on film. There's certain sports that I think lose something when they're sort of flipped over to movies. And hockey is one that I think has both a very high ceiling and a pretty high floor in terms of sort of cinema and how it translates. Some of the movies that we'll talk about today, notwithstanding.
Yeah, I feel like you specifically did not describe most of the movies that we picked for.
Yeah, right. Exactly. This.
Yeah. One of the movies that we picked that does kind of hit those high highs, Cam chose. Cam, want to run through, like, I don't think you really need to describe too much why you chose the movie Miracle, but that was your choice.
Why I chose Miracle. All right. Oh man, that's a long one, I guess. But I guess to give a somewhat concise version, I think it is a movie that really displays hockey very well, which is kind of something that Nate was just talking about. I think that has sort of the higher ceiling as far as displaying hockey in like a somewhat realistic sense and giving it that kind of quick feel that you feel when you're on the ice. One of my favorite facts about Miracle is that they try to decide between teaching actors how to play hockey and hockey players how to act, and they decided to take the hockey players and teach them how to act, with the exception of Jimmy Craig, the actor who plays the goalie, because they could throw a mask on a stunt double pretty much and have him play goalie. And so they snag the guy who ends up being in Friends. But I think that decision was so important because it's a movie that so centrally obviously focuses on hockey, and I think a lot of movies kind of use hockey as a side note or something, but I think it's very clear that the directors and such made the decision to like really focus on the sport as a central part of the movie, and I think they really nailed that. So I think that propels it to the upper echelon of most sports movies, along with a few other things, but we'll get there.
Yeah. So speaking it took of the Armageddon way, where it taught oil drillers how to go to space instead of astronauts how to dig for oil. Makes so much sense.
So yeah, speaking of movies that made hockey the side thing, Zach, why did you pick Indian Horse?
I don't really know. I think it was one of the I googled like best hockey movies of all time, I think, and it, you know, slapped
it. You found it like 12 pages over on Google.
Yeah, it was a smaller film that came out in like 2016, something like that.
2017.
I looked it up. Yeah, and it like it got some like festival love, and you know, seemed like an interesting concept focusing on the Canadian Native American residential school system and hockey within that. So the synopsis seemed pretty intriguing. I think we can, you know, talk about what actually ended up happening from the movie as far as how effective that was. But I think the idea behind it was what pulled me into it.
Yeah, reasonable. Nate, I have a really good idea of why you chose Slapshot, but why don't you go ahead and give us the actual story?
Yeah, Paul Newman.
Yep.
And next.
Yeah, it's Paul Newman. It's the director who directed The Sting and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Spoiler for Myla Keith.
Yeah, right. There you go. So yeah, this, you know, was right in the pocket for me, and was one of those movies that had been on the watch list for a long time, and this was a great reason to watch it.
All right, so my story is a little different. I chose Youngblood. Turns out you would have had to like buy a DVD if you wanted to watch it, I guess. So in retrospect, probably should have picked Red Army, which is a documentary about the Russian national team, but didn't think on my feet enough and ended up
instead you got Sean William Scott.
Who I don't think is the problem with that movie.
Certainly not. Well, I mean, not the chief problem.
The movie is Goon. It's I've seen it before, so I
that's the criteria.
Yeah, I remembered liking it when I saw it, so figured it was a decent addition in place of Youngblood, which I don't know a whole lot about Youngblood other than it's Rob Lowe and Patrick Swayze, and there's a lot of really bad hockey in it, and I was really intrigued by that. So Drew, you picked Ice Guardians. Why?
because Miracle, Slapshot, yeah, Miracle and Slapshot were taken. Those are
and
my top two.
Indian Horse.
I had never heard of Indian Horse other than before I even heard that was one that we had to watch. I saw it pop up on Netflix as like suggested. I was like, wait, there's a hockey movie on Netflix that I haven't seen. Oh my God. And then it worked out. So I was forced to watch it. It was kind of like an idea that I would watch it at some point in my life. And then it became that. But yeah, no, I like the documentary side of things. I think it shakes it up. I admit it's very, very long, but I don't know. I think it raises a lot of good points.
It's not that long. It's not even two hours.
It's not 2 hours? I thought it was like 2.5.
108 minutes.
It's 108.
Oh. Yeah.
It's pretty long. It just feels... It feels really much longer.
See, because they go too in depth and break things up too much. I think there's a lot of they could have just skimmed over. It could be like an hour, and like it would have done everything enough justice. But despite its length, I think it's good, and I will defend it when we get there.
All right, that's gonna take some work. All right, well, Cam's having some technical difficulties, I think. So. We'll move on to our discussion about Miracle without him.
No, we can't do that.
I'm here. I'm just trying to turn my camera off so that it hopefully uses less internet and you guys come in clear. So we'll see how it works.
I think it's your download speed, not your upload speed.
Yeah, so I feel like most people are familiar with what Miracle is, but it's the story of the 1980 USA hockey team, Miracle on Ice. I'd say... Oh, it was 2004, Disney movie, kind of in the same vein as Remember the Titans, kind of doing like a dramatization of a real life thing. I think Remember the Titans probably took a few more liberties, but it's Kurt Russell playing Herb Brooks, a guy from Minnesota. And it's a fucking awesome performance. Anyone want to jump in with initial thoughts?
I'll just say briefly, there's a lot going on in the world and country that makes sometimes when I question my patriotism, I watch Miracle and I like, you know, I want to like wear a I don't know, like a Speedo with an American flag on it and like an American flag cape and fly around like Superman. Like all I needed to say.
When I go to the gym, I just listen to the Al Michaels call at the end of the game.
Miracles? Yes.
I had seen this movie, I think right around when it came out, but hadn't revisited it until now. And I thought it held up like really well. It's pretty straightforward. You know, there's some family stuff at home. There's some, you know, side things about who's making the team and who's not. But for the most part, it's just a story of the team going up into the Olympics. And it does a very effective job about showing, what they were up against, how big of underdogs they were. They touch on the geopolitical stuff, but it's not super, super heavy handed. They don't go too heavy into that. And then, you know, it's Kurt Russell, who's in basically every single scene, you know, being a movie star. So, and like we talked about earlier, the actual hockey in this movie is incredibly well done and shot beautifully. And makes you feel like you're actually watching hockey players rather than watching like shitty actors try and play hockey.
Totally. I think that and you were alluding to this, Zach, but the movie does such a good job of getting out of the way of the story. Like the story is so compelling in and of itself that the movie does kind of, and I mean this in the most complimentary way, the bare bones in terms of, trying to trick you into being invested in it because it knows that it's the type of story that will kind of grab you. So it relies on the good performances. It relies on like a lot of really great hockey scenes and like performances by people. And I think this is a, you know, potentially just a byproduct of the fact that they chose unseasoned actors for it, but they were unseasoned actors playing younger kids in a situation where they were kind of out of their depth. And that translates really well in a way that sometimes when you go the route of the unseasoned actor, it doesn't always, sometimes they're just not able to carry the emotional burden of a thing. And with this, part of the emotional burden of the movie is the fact that they're young kids and they're kind of tasked with something that is way more outsized and way more global than what they thought they were walking into. I'll also just say more specifically that the like sequence of it works with most sports, but it comes up the most in hockey movies. I feel like the listing your name and what city you're from thing down the line, I get like a fucking, it's like an adrenaline shot to the jugular every time. It's crazy how much that hits me always. It's in this, it's in the Mighty Ducks, it's in all of, I just like, I really, it's really visceral, especially when they list any places from Minnesota.
Russ Tyler, Los Angeles, California.
I'll jump in and just kind of add to that, but like I've seen this movie probably no less than 150 times, and like every time in those last 20 minutes I'm like worried that like history is going to shift and like they're somehow going to lose. I'm going to be so disappointed because this is finally the time that like they lost, and I was like, fuck, like the whole movie's ruined forever. But kind of on that note, like sort of like as you had mentioned, this story is so compelling like in and of itself, and obviously there's a few parts that are Hollywooded up, but for the most part, like, it's one of those like moments that when you're watching it happen in live sports, it's too good to be true. And like, you know, you're like, oh, if this happened in a movie, it wouldn't be realistic. Where it is like the group of kids, like a bunch of college players playing against like army soldiers, essentially on the other side, they get their shit rocked by the team leading into the games. You know, the team just beat the NHL All-Stars, the comebacks they had in pretty much every game. And then even like to the point of scoring a last second goal in the way that they did with literally a tenth of a second left on the clock, that actually happened. And then the team captain, who is obviously a big part of the movie, scoring the go-ahead goal against the Soviets, like all of that scripted so well realistically that they, like Nate had said, you didn't really have to deviate from the truth too much. One of the parts, not to totally spoil it, but I was curious how much they did Hollywood it up. And the one thing that I found that was a little bit unrealistic was in the post Norway game when they're skating the suicides, essentially the Herbies as they call them. They did do that for like 45 minutes after the game in the dark, the whole nine yards,
7 hours.
Well, yeah, it was like about an hour, I think, or a little under. And they actually did turn the lights off on them and all that shit happened, but it didn't end with the heroic Mike Rizzioni scene. It ended when another player smashed his stick on the glass. And then Herb let him go, which I kind of think is also badass in and of itself, but probably doesn't quite fit the theme of the Disney movie as well. So I think it gives you a little more insight into the type of guy he really was too, though. So I like that.
Yeah, I would say probably the most unrealistic thing about this is the lack of language. Herb Brooks was pretty famously a guy who swore like a sailor and definitely didn't tone things down for a Disney movie, but I do understand, like, if you're making this inspirational movie via Disney, you can't really lean too hard into that. Although he did call a player a candy ass, so
yeah, that was like the harsh Disney line, I'm sure, back then. So that's good for them. That's why it was rated PG-13.
With the suicide scene, I did get caught on it this time, because that's like a sequence. I've seen this, you know, probably four or five times over my life. And so that scene is kind of like just emblazoned into my memory, but I didn't remember the specifics of it. And I didn't remember that he just says Michael Ruzioni, like just says his name and nothing after it. Just and then Herb, yeah, just waits. And then Herb goes, "And where are you from?" And he's like, "USA." Like they had this like choreographed dance to it. It was so
waiting
funny.
For the cue. Yeah.
My other favorite thing is that Herb Brooks didn't have the whistle. I don't know if that's actually how it works, but it's like, I am powerless to make them run another suicide if that other guy doesn't play the whistle.
And that's the tension in the scene. If he's going to blow the whistle.
It's like in Crimson Tide where they have to go through and like, do the steps for decoding the message.
I think it was like just stellar acting though. They were just like, can you like very, very reluctantly blow a whistle? Like, how well can you portray that feeling? And he did it many times, and it was like, communicated the feeling well.
His face acting in that scene is phenomenal. It's just like the amount of like conflict he's sort of like going through. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I wish they just zoomed in more and more every time.
I mean, it's a really tough, like this movie is basically just propaganda against load management as a thing. It's like, if you do this, you beat the Russians.
Absolutely.
And like the reality, if they had gone actually as long as they showed it going, like it just would have been like blown out ACLs left and right. Unbelievable stuff.
Yeah, this movie is, I think, ruined USA hockey for years following because they kept trying to build teams like this to beat Canada, who, you know, just put every great scorer in the NHL on their Olympic team. And meanwhile, Boone Jenner's going to, that's one for the hockey heads out there, going to the Olympics trying to, yeah.
Which Jenner is that? Is it not Kylie?
I'm pretty sure Boone Jenner is the younger one. Is Canadian anyway. But they're just sending like just guys who hit and don't really have any skill. For years, there have been some really bad choices by the Team USA GMs in terms of players, and I think you can trace a lot of that back to the Miracle on Ice, and probably some of that to this movie.
A little bit, maybe. Yeah, I do have. I don't know how long we're gonna focus on Miracle, but I do want to throw in. I have a little bit of a personal connection. Being from upstate New York, I've gotten to play on the rink a couple times, which definitely adds to my like obsession with the movie. Cause it, when you've seen it enough and you know, when you're going out to Lake Placid as a kid playing in a tournament, like you always watch Miracle on the way up there and you're ready to run through a wall when you get to the rink. But it is cool kind of feeling that like energy there that, you know, it's obviously all made up to be, designed around that event now. And there's shit all over the place about it, which is kind of cool. It's like a museum sort of in a way. But my mom was actually in Lake Placid during the games and had gone to a couple other hockey games, but obviously was not at that game. But she was like really young, and she tells me she was in the car with like my grandfather, and the streets were pretty packed and stuff. But when the news hit the radios and stuff that the United States had like upset the Soviets, she said like people were just getting out of their cars and like pretty much partying in the street. And she was super young and was like terrified because she had no idea what was going on. And there were people just getting out of their cars and like near rioting in the street. But I was just laughed at that, like seeing what's going on the outside.
All I said was that it made me want to wear an American Speedo. So I wanted to. I think I'd just be repeating if I said all the, like, it's just amazing kind of stuff. But one thing I'll add is that I think it's really accessible. I think if you've never watched a hockey game before, you can follow along and you can get like just as into this kind of movie, because like the hockey really, while the hockey is like both the main object of the movie, it is also kind of falls to the background where it's just anyone can understand this huge struggle and like impossible odds and overcoming that, and for, you know, pride of the country. And I think that's common in any sports movie that kind of goes down as a classic, that is it's accessible to all, not just the diehard sports fan. So I think it does that very, very well.
And just hockey in general, you score one goal at a time and then time runs out, you know?
Yep.
It's pretty easy to understand. Like, they have more than us and that's how little time is left. Like,
yeah, they go the clock a lot. They make good use of it for sure.
Yeah, a lot harder to, I guess, explain to somebody who doesn't know football why a touchdown is 6 points, right. And yeah. Field goals 3,
but maybe 7, but maybe 8, depending on the situation. And if you kick it badly, you can get it back.
So it's 4th and 3. It'd be a 56-yard field goal. I don't. There's 50 seconds left.
Why are we rehashing last night's game?
I need another drink.
Yeah. So I think the only other thing I definitely want to mention is at the end they go through like the real life players and like show their headshots and everything, and like really everyone depressing. Works in finance.
It's a
like
financial analyst.
It's all, yeah, right, they're all financial analysts. Yeah. Wild.
And the only bad one was like working toward his bachelor's degree in something. And I was like, ugh. Sorry, bud.
This is counting the years.
Yeah.
Like, hold on.
2004. I mean, yeah, no shame.
Good on him. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So I guess the transition here is from accessible hockey movies to just like wildly inaccessible, very depressing, not really a hockey movie. Indian Horse is the story of a kid coming up in the residential schools in Canada in the 1950s and kind of how he gets the opportunity to play hockey and how that isn't necessarily a reprieve or anything. Although I will say the tagline for this movie is god awful. Let me see if I can find this. It is, Saul is a great native hockey player who overcomes racism in the 1970s, then ultimately becomes tempted by alcoholism.
Whoops.
Nope.
One, nope. Not with the movie.
No.
I will say the accurate, also wrong.
The alcoholism is completely unrelated. It just happens to occur at the end.
Alcoholism isn't the thing that tempts people. Yeah. It's
tempted by alcoholism, overcomes racism.
Some really tough phrases in
cool.
there.
That's some classic mission accomplished banner bullshit.
But does anyone want to guess what the tagline was for this?
Yeah, produced by Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, that's basically it. It was, you have the gift, you have the vision. Which I assume is a lie.
It's better than, it's better than You Are Glory.
Oh, boy.
Wow. It's better than a drinkable beer you can taste. Really
that's true.
No, it's not.
No.
tough movie. I think bears mentioning that off the top that it's produced, adapted, directed by non-native people. I think the toughest thing for me was reading that I was trying to see what the director's history was, and basically just like a Clint Eastwood fanboy who eventually ended up working for Clint Eastwood's production company and read the book. A Canadian himself, did not know about the residential school systems, read the book, and then 6 months before it went into production, basically yelled at Clint Eastwood and said, I have to direct this movie. And I got to say, it shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to give a little bit of background for those who might not be aware, is the residential school system itself. So that was, Canada's Christian churches for Native America, or Christian schools for Native Americans,
assimilation schools, basically.
Yeah, assimilation schools. And you know, there was a bunch of abuse, both sexual and physical, you know, stripping away the culture of the Native people, you know, forcing them to not speak in their own native language, some horrific tragedies.
A lot of murder, more and more
is being revealed about it, you know, as this goes on. You know, just in what, May or March or something, there were a bunch of bodies discovered at a few residential. It's just like the whole thing's terrible. So this touches on that as a, the hockey is a vehicle to tell a story of someone who was abused in a residential school. And that idea for a story, I was super like intrigued by and wanted to see a movie made of, and apparently the book is quite good. I am not as down on this movie as I think a few others. I didn't think it was great. It's super heavy-handed. It tells, it doesn't show, but I don't think it's poorly structured. I think, you know, you at least, you don't get the classic reprieve at the end and it all works out pretty well. It's just a kind of punishing movie through and through. And that is just a little tough for a topic that is very tough.
Yeah. To clarify, this is a big swing and miss. I think it's a fine movie. It's just like, yeah, it's hard to swing and miss on a topic like this.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately what hurt it the most for me. I think if it was an entirely fictional story, I wouldn't like it. And if it being based in fact and about a subject that not nearly enough attention has been drawn to within film and within sort of as all this sort of stuff is being uncovered, we're talking about, you know, discovering all these bodies back in like earlier this year, the National Truth and Reconciliation Day, which just happened on the 30th. Like to have that story, while I agree, Zach, that I think the fact that there's not a "and it all worked out" spin at the end, which would have been problematic its own way, I'm thankful for that. At the same time, it felt like for a lot of the movie, it felt like that there was a distance between you and the trauma, where it felt more voyeuristic and more like it was somebody who didn't know this experience was just kind of like hitting you over the head with this litany of trauma without understanding how to show you that as a lived experience. And so it felt I feel like that's where you get into this idea of, if you have more attachment to the story, it's not purely your identity, but I think that's a huge factor. If you have more connection to the story, there's oftentimes more capability to know how to tell that story in a way that will allow you to convey the depth of it and not just the litany of trauma. And that's what it came off as. It felt like if we hit you over the head with enough of this stuff, you'll know that it was bad.
Yeah. I think, you know, Chris, you said it was a swing and a miss. I think it was a foul tip. I think they were like, it's the right idea, and they were kind of getting at it, but kind of like you said, Nate, like it just didn't like put you there. There was a distance, it felt. And I think a big part of that is like language. Like, I feel like for example, one of his teammates on his new team at one point said, like, "Don't make me look bad." I feel like realistically, there was probably a lot more in all of it, cursing and all. And I get they were trying to like keep it a little more on the PG side somehow, even though it's like such a heavy topic. I don't really know what the aim. I feel like you got to commit or make it like a really happy kids movie. Like, there's no other way. And making it a happy kids movie would not do
justice at all.
So they just didn't commit to that. So it felt like, okay, you're seeing them get beat up, and there was like some physical violence there. And I feel like, you know, you're kind of put into those situations face to face. But like, I feel like there was a lot more verbal abuse that was done, and that would kind of make it hit home a little bit more and really, you know, start to take pieces away at that window that you're really looking through. So yeah, I think it's a foul tip, right idea, but just very poor execution in making you feel like, oh shit, like it's more than this guy just being like, this is inconvenient, and turn to alcoholism. Like, it felt like they were really simplifying it.
Well, yeah, okay, right, but so, after he overcame racism, just to be clear.
He was by alcoholism.
He decided to quit because he saw beer and was like,
he saw alcoholism and said, that looks great, let me try that.
And then he's like, you know what? I overcame the alcoholism, and I'm going to work in the mine the rest of my life. Like that, like,
yeah, the happy ending is he works in a small town coal mine.
Oh my God. Oh man.
I'll kind of piggyback off of everything that you guys said, because I definitely felt all those things with the depth and the issues there. And I think it was one of the few movies where, as I was watching it, I felt like it could have benefited from an hour more of movie to, really, I think the thing that was missing for me was kind of developing those relationships that really made you care about the things. Like, you had the touches with Lonnie, and you had the touches with the girl that ends up killing herself and stuff like that, but you never really felt like emotionally invested in those characters. Obviously, you care for them as people and as oppressed people and people that are being abused and that sort of thing, but I felt like there could have been a little bit more development of the relationships between Saul and those people, so that it kind of hit home a little bit more. And I feel like they kind of just skimmed by it and kind of used it as a tool. And sort of like Drew said, I feel like they never just really committed to a thing. They didn't really commit it to like, all right, this is going to be centrally focused on hockey. They didn't really commit and say, hey, we're going to really just focus on the residential schools and get it right. They kind of got pieces of all of it and tried to put it all together. And I think the narrative, obviously, of trying to keep to a somewhat real story handicaps you there in a way. But I also think that there was a way they could have dove in there a little bit more and tried to just develop it a little bit more and make you care about each of the things that's happening as it's unfolding.
I don't know if I'm giving the movie too much credit, but I did kind of think that, at least for me, it felt like he wasn't even afforded the opportunity to get close to some of those people because of the way the school is set up and because of the strict rules and structures and the fact that he couldn't even speak, you know, his own native language with, I'm forgetting the name of, Lonnie.
Ojibwe was the language.
Where it felt like, you know, and I feel like we have to talk about spoilers in this, for the quote unquote reveal at the end that the one priest that is not portrayed as a physical abuser turns out to be a sexual abuser. And I don't think it was a total, like, the good guy is the bad guy all along. I think you get a little bit of hints of some trepidation and some distance between Saul and the priest, but you know, it kind of showed that there was never any reprieve for students in the residential school system. And this was a showcase of it. And that kind of worked for me as a plotting structure, as far as writing and the way those are portrayed, you know, that missed a little bit
on paper for sure. And I would be interested to read the originating text, because on paper it does work. Like if you're talking through like that kind of story, that's compelling. The jarring way in which it's just kind of like dropped on you doesn't feel earned in any way. It's not set up well. There's just a lot of very jarring, like the age jumps, because there are time jumps, and the character of Saul is played by three different actors, and those time jumps feel really jarring. Like there's no real catching up between, like, it kind of feels like a different actor playing the same character at the same age. Like nothing has happened between. There's no kind of explaining what's happened. It's just kind of like, okay, now we need to somehow signify that time has moved without putting in the work to make sure people understand what's happened in that time.
Yeah, I think if you wanted to, you could do like a purely mechanics focused critique of this, which I think that's where a lot of the sort of like newer director, unseasoned director stuff comes up, even before you get into conversations about the identity. I think specifically with this sort of reveal at the end of hot Dario Naharis, for those Game of Thrones fans, who is decidedly not that in this movie. His reveal as an abuser, I think the way that it's deployed feels like it's contingent on an expectation that you as a viewer are going to think that he's a better person earlier in the movie, rather than watching the movie and seeing this person who is completely complicit and a horrible person, just not the most active physical abuser, is also a physical abuser, right? And like that's why I think that turn felt like such a failure for me, because it felt like this moment of being like, wait, did you think that I thought that he was cool? And now I'm shocked that he's not.
There was like a little bit of hope there, but totally just kind of saw that they eventually you're going to realize, oh, he was bad, if not worse.
Character of priest at a residential school is already the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. And like you would think, but the little bit of hope I had was, like, he's helping Saul get out, and it's like, oh, maybe he's realizing like this is a bad thing and he's gonna help some kids, like, yo, come be super gifted at hockey and that's the only thing I see in you and that's why I'll get you out, not because you're a human being. But just a little bit of hope there, but yeah, in the end it was like that was the most you've really felt, like that was the biggest plot twist.
Well, the other scene that kind of confirms that everything that we've just been saying is the one scene where they meet again for the first time since he leaves.
Which
where
felt
it's
like such a confounding choice to put that in if you're going to then reveal it.
Yeah, because the idea is that he admits that everything that was going on was bad, and so now, once again, to your point, Nate, am I supposed to, like, is this supposed to be like further confirming that this is like a good guy? Because if he's just now realizing that all those things are bad, then no, that makes him worse.
I,
I kind of took it as even the people that weren't like everyone was bad in a system like that, and it was different veins, and the people that think they are doing good by doing these acts of service where he gets them out of the schools are still fucking abusers, you know, if you participate in this kind of thing. I think it's what I took it as is him trying to give himself an excuse for how he acted, and less so an admission, and more trying to convince himself.
I agree with that. I'm going to jump in with a lighter part here where one of my favorite scenes was when they were first deciding to let Saul go, and you have like the one hardcore sister who's like, we can't let him abandon God and blah, blah, blah. And then there's like the headmaster father, and he's pretty much just like, well, yeah, Jesus, but like, did you see those deeks? Like, God gave him silky mitts for something.
Send him out there.
Like, his whole mission. He's so God gave him a
silky mitt. Sizzle, bro.
Like, he's so committed to the residential school system that he's committing all this abuse. Yeah, but then he's just like, all right, I mean, I'm all for God, but you see that kid's clapper.
Which, he's like, got
there's God in this child.
I sincerely hope that they like got that was like a condemnation of the residential school, and are not like, yeah, look at this good priest, you know, like I can see it going either way. But it is like, yeah, that sequence was unbelievable because it was just like, oh, cool. Like as soon as you get someone who can do something that you think looks cool, like great, send them. Yeah, awesome, cool. All those regulations we have, yeah, toss them out. Wild.
The Bruising Birds podcast is sponsored by DraftKings. Hockey is back, and DraftKings Sportsbook has an unbelievable offer to celebrate the greatest sport on ice. New customers can bet just $1 on any hockey game and win hundreds of dollars in free bets if either team scores a goal. It doesn't matter if it's a one-time clapper or a deft deflection. However they light the lamp, you win. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state, DraftKings won't leave you empty-handed. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes all season long with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Sports Contests. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use promo code THPN. Throw down $1 on any hockey game and win 100 in free bets if either team scores a goal. This week, one puck in the net bets you a big win with promo code THPN at DraftKings Sportsbook. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit, $1 wage required. One per customer. Word restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Yeah, turns out not the most moral. Who knew?
Yeah.
Watch Spotlight for more of the corrupt Christian.
Is Spotlight the only movie that has more decent Boston accents than Miracle? Moving on to Slapshot.
Ooh, yes. Happy times.
Depending on who you ask.
I guess. But, yeah, I think it was just going to be... I don't know. It's less heavy.
Yeah,
it's definitely that's happier. Yeah,
wasn't saying like.
I mean, but depending
on the same amount of piss in this movie,
same
though.
Amount of alcoholism, maybe more. Yeah. So, Slapshot, story of Paul Newman being a little older than he was in the previous films that we did on Ballot.
Still hot.
Yeah.
Even with the teeth.
Certainly portrayed that way. Yeah, it's a story about a minor league or independent league hockey team in a fictional town, assuming somewhere in the middle of Pennsylvania, where the owner, the mill of the town is going under, and so the owner's worried about people not attending hockey games. Obviously, that would be a problem. It's like the 1950s, 1960s, or is it later?
70s.
It was made in 77.
So it takes place in
yeah, more or less real time. It's West Virginia, so it looks like it's 20 years behind the times.
Oh, is right. It West Virginia?
Yeah, it's Charlestown, West Virginia.
When did they start wearing helmets in hockey?
It was grandfathered in. So I don't think until like early 2000s, late 90s, it was like Jesus that everyone Christ. Had them because
of the oh, wow.
By the 90s, it was like probably 90-95% of players.
That was not the internet.
I was not prepared for that.
No, okay. The NHL also just grandfathers everything. Like Chara is one of the last players to not have a visor now.
Yeah, since he's been in the league for 20 years, he's not required.
Well, he's actually in the movie. He's been playing since then.
how does that line up with when were concussions invented? What was the date?
We'll get to that in Ice Guardians.
About 2014, actually.
Yeah, okay, sick. Yeah.
So the mill's going under, the owner's trying to sell the team, and basically it's this team's last year, and they're trying anything they can to try and gin up some sort of revenue and maybe try to find a buyer somewhere else, specifically in Florida. And hilarity ensues, and oh boy, some problematic stuff ensues.
Let's focus on the hilarity to start, because I feel like there's a lot of that in this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I will say about the problematic things, it's mostly like the era in which this film was made, and I think probably accurately captures what hockey players
in
the
90s. It feels very representative of what people in these situations would be doing.
It doesn't feel glorifying.
Right, yeah. It doesn't feel like it's going out of the way being like, isn't this cool? It doesn't feel like it's necessarily condemned either, but it's certainly different than, like, there are other examples of this stuff that we run into that this is like what I would expect these people would be saying to each other on the rink.
I'll start off by saying I think the Hansen brothers are maybe some of the best character inventions in the history of sports cinema.
Phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
I was a Hansen brother for Halloween once.
Hell yeah.
Pretty awesome.
T-shirts and everything. Yeah, I couldn't afford a jersey because I was in like high school. So I just got t-shirts printed, me and my buddy, and we taped our glasses up and shit. It was a good time.
I think their introduction, trying to get a quarter back from the vending machine, is incredibly perfect. And then I think the thing that cemented them on this latest rewatch as one of my favorite things ever is the scene where Paul Newman's trying to give this kind of like low, subtle speech about just like, you know, kind of taking it to the other team. And then they respond by going, "Yeah, let's go, let's go."
So
Paul Newman's just like, "Yeah, what they said."
Tinfoil in the knuckles.
Yeah, fuck them up.
I love this movie just because it has the single greatest shift in hockey history in it, with the Hansen brothers tearing it up.
Their introductory shift.
Yeah, I think that like Mario Lemieux first shot, first goal, Hansen brothers. Like I think that's
in no particular order.
No particular order. I think for me, it's a lot of nostalgia. I watched this like probably younger than I should have watched it, but my dad was like, "You're watching Slapshot." I was probably like 8 or 9, I've watched it so many times since, and you know, as I got older, I understood more. Like, oh yeah, definitely shouldn't have paid witness to this when I was that age. But it was the first time I saw breasts on television.
Hey. Wow!
So
cheers.
And I think for the time too, the footage of hockey itself, like it was really good. It was really good if you're considering the era. I think if it's on par with Miracle in that way because of just noting the era difference there when the movies were made. I think that's 3 decades apart because Miracle was early 2000s.
Yeah, this is
late 70s. Yeah. So almost 3 decades apart. Classic, absolute classic. Just I think qualifies as one of those comedy classics that like
some of the one-liners in this are just like,
yes,
unreal. I genuinely almost did a spit take at I'm listening to the fucking song.
One of the best lines in all of cinema.
It's
honestly
long been my favorite line from this movie.
Unbelievable.
Even just the one shots of like the classic shot of him like in warm-ups crossing each other at the red line, he just knocks him out. Like that little clip is just like instantly like, oh, Slapshot, great movie. Like can hit you
a
with
lot
those.
More sticks to the side of the head than I was expecting. I'll be honest with you.
I learned from Ice Guardians that
yeah, it's good hockey.
The one other like bigger picture thing I do want to say is I do like that this is kind of an anti sports movie where what do they do at the end? They just beat the fuck out of each other and lose and get sold and go to a different team, you know? Like
the guy from Twin Peaks takes off all of his clothes
in a very long scene.
Yeah. Like,
almost as long as Ice Guardians.
Yeah.
So I did want to ask what you guys think the thesis statement of this movie is based on how the movie ends.
I think it's
very hard to figure out what that is.
I think it's get pucks in deep, throw some bodies,
go to the corners, go to the dirty areas.
I think it's basically just that. I think it's just what you hear from every hockey player interview ever, just summarized in the film.
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't know if it's... I think it's not teamwork, is what I figured out.
Certainly not teamwork, no. It feels very nihilistic. It feels very, like, nothing matters. It's fine. It's just like it's proto-Joker. It's watch the world burn. Like, you know, and I think that works for it. It just, you know, it's... The entire concept is, like, it's not going to work out, so do something that's going to... Yeah, fuck it.
I do really like the ending because as the movie goes along, I was paying more attention to what, like, the things that I expected to happen versus what actually happens. And you do get that character. I forget what the character's name is, but it's the guy from Twin Peaks who is, like, I guess the other main character to Paul Newman.
He's the other attractive guy in the movie.
In his whole thing is I'm not gonna fight. And so I think a different movie might be convincing that guy, like, oh, he needs to, like, fight and show that he can get down with the big boys to get his wife back, and like that in the 1970s that doesn't seem too far-fetched of a plot. And no, the thing is, he just, like, goes and makes an ass out of himself because fuck it, this team's not going to exist tomorrow anyway. Showing that he's not, like, uptight or anything, I guess, is kind of the ending of that movie.
Yeah. I'm just happy we had another entry into the Harlan County, USA cinematic universe.
Yeah.
So
workers' rights.
Spoiler for my Lakeith Stanfield award. Yeah.
The soundtrack for this movie is phenomenal. It's
amazing.
Really great. Like, front to back, just absolute bangers.
Love it.
Yeah.
There's some sirens.
Yes,
oh, yeah, that's me. I live in New York City.
That's me. I'm in Vermont in the woods.
That would be very worrisome if there were sirens.
Yeah, that means some shit's going down.
Not great. All right, so this is the time at which we will cut between Brews and Bruins podcasts.
That's our theme music.